I'm Dick Hayne, and I am a Lutheran pastor, but not serving a parish, and have been for the past 2.5 years worked with Bread for the World, which is an organization based in Washington, D.C., that lobbies on hunger issues. I think it's very important to get that point clear. We don't have feeding programs. We don't have trucks, and we don't dig wells, and we don't give grants of money. We lobby in behalf of the poorest of the poor. We lobby Congress, and Congress then makes certain decisions. We also don't handle any of the money that we lobby for. A lot of organizations go to Congress for, you know, tax breaks for their group, whatever it is, or benefits for their group, or whatever it may be. One of the things that earns respect for Bread for the World and other groups like it in the Capitol is that we do not lobby in our own self-interest. We don't handle the money. We don't get, you know, a lot of times you get a grant, you take 12, 15, 20% off the top for administrative expenses and all that kind of stuff. We're not involved in any of that. Prior to working with Bread for the World, for quite a long time, in retrospect, I can't imagine how I managed to do that, but I lived in Texas, and I taught at a seminary at Texas Christian University. So that's a little about my background. And what I do with Bread for the World is I travel, and I speak in churches and so forth. We have, for those of you in the Moline-Davenport area, Bread for the World has an office in Chicago that covers Illinois, Indiana, and Missouri. For those of you in Minnesota, we have an office in Minneapolis that covers Minnesota, Iowa, North and South Dakota. I have, unfortunately at the moment, a sort of 2.5 loads. I have Texas, Louisiana, Oklahoma, Washington, Oregon, Idaho, Alaska, Maryland, Delaware, and Pennsylvania. But it's just a kind of a temporary doubling up, and that's going to be alleviated a bit soon. What I'd like to do is I would like to, for starters, walk through this fact sheet with you. Because, in a way, it really does cover, I think, a lot of the questions that people most often ask. Although, actually, we could begin with questions. I'm open to that. Let's walk through this and then see, because I think it'll cover a number of your questions and then see what questions you may have beyond that. This was printed in August of 87. Some of the figures are just a little bit dated by now. But it's still, the content is essentially true. A few of the dollar figures and so forth are a little bit different, of course. You know, things go up. Population goes up a bit. Spending goes up a bit. Number one, worldwide, how many hungry people are there? They estimate, and the estimate still is roughly, 500 million people were hungry in the world today. It says excluding China because there's no data on China, or at least there wasn't. I don't know whether we can get China data these days or not, but China keeps its own figures for itself and simply doesn't release them. So you have no way of including them in when you're talking about world figures, you know, how many this or how many that. It goes on to say under number one, approximately 750 million people in developing countries lived in absolute poverty. Today that figure is about 1 billion. About 1 billion people in third world countries live at a level defined as an income level below which adequate standards of nutrition, shelter, and personal amenities cannot be maintained. About half the victims are children. It is still true that about 40,000 children die each day from hunger-related causes. Now, hunger-related causes, number two, does not mean starvation. There are not 40,000 children starving to death in the world today. The number of people who actually starve to death is relatively small. Hunger-related diseases is the way you usually hear it put. What that means is that you take a child who doesn't have adequate nutrition. Let's say they're under 1 year of age. And let's say they catch a bad case of diarrhea. I mean, something as simple. You know, we travel maybe in a third world country and we catch diarrhea or something and we think, well, it's just because we're traveling there. Not true at all. It's people, a lot of third world people also catch diarrhea and so forth in countries where the water supply is not adequate. And say this child is doesn't have good nutrition. You know, how do you survive something like that? Well, over time your body has built up certain nutrients, and if you're in fairly good health, you can generally survive something like that. Or simple diseases that a body can fight off if the body has just basic nutrition. Simple things. So usually it's not pure starvation per se, though there is some of that. It tends to be more chronic malnutrition. Where is hunger primarily concentrated? Number three, 2/3 of the undernourished people in the world live in South Asia, 1/5 in Sub-Saharan Africa. I got just a few random figures that I happen to have with me. This is nothing like comprehensive or anything, but it gives you some idea, you know, of what some of the comparisons look like. In Indonesia, the income per person in 1987, which is the most recent figures that are available, most recent comparative figures that are available, the income per person was about $450. In Brazil, it was $2,020. In Malaysia, it was $1,810. Kind of amazing, because those two are very close to each other, culturally and geographically and so forth. In Tanzania, it was $180 per person. In Ghana, $390, and in Kenya, $330. Infant deaths under 1 year per 1,000 live births. Now, what that means is, first you have to get born live. This is not talking about children who died in childbirth or spontaneous abortions or induced abortion, anything like that. We're talking here about children who get born live and die before their first birthday. In Indonesia, the figure is 71 per thousand, Brazil 63 per thousand, Malaysia 24 per thousand, Tanzania 106 per thousand, Ghana 90 per thousand, and Kenya 72. So you see, what you see here is a very wide variation. And this account, this sort of thing, these two things kind of depict what we're talking about there in terms of some of the third world dimensions, Asia, Africa, and Latin America. And of course, as in all countries, it's worse in some parts of the country than in other parts of the country. I mean, there are children who die of hunger-related diseases in the United States. But of course, the United States standard of living is at least the dollar income is much higher. Number four, it's estimated that 20 million U.S. citizens lack enough to eat at least 2 days each month. Five, is hunger getting worse or receding? The percent declined from 70 to 80, but the numbers have been increasing since 1980. I know it doesn't seem that way to us, but the situation in many third world countries is not getting better. It is getting dramatically worse. Some of those countries are sliding down a very greasy, quick, steep slope. And the situation has gotten quite desperate in some. Yeah.
Is it because the population is increasing so rapidly?
Well, we'll come to that question, but we can talk about it now. No, not primarily. I know that people like to think of population as the cause. It is a factor. Obviously, if you have double and triple and quadruple your people, it's a problem. But in fact, we have more than enough food to feed everybody in the world, and unless we have an enormous drought, I mean, if we had 2 or 3 years of serious drought, then the situation would look different. But if things continue as we expect them to, we will have enough food to feed everybody in the world at least to the year 2000, 2010. We have lots and lots and lots of food. Population contributes, but it is not a major cause. It is not presently a major cause of hunger. Generally, what the evidence shows is that if you raise people's standard of living, they have fewer children. Now, I'm not speaking against the programs of population control and that sort of thing. But generally, even if you just think in the United States, who on the whole is most likely to have lots of kids, and who on the whole is most likely to have very few kids? There's almost a relationship between wealth and number of kids. People who are poorer tend to have more kids. So that the way that, you know, that a lot of organizations, Bread for the World, Oxfam, and others, the way that we want to go at dealing with hunger, the primary way for dealing with hunger, is to raise the standard of living so that people can have enough food. If they don't have to worry about the children they have dying before they're 5 years old or 10 years old, then they don't have so many children. That's the way it tends to go. You had your hand up back there. It kind of flashed up and went back down again. Yes.
You were predicting, you know, the amount of food that would be available. Well, this afternoon, before supper, we were here with the
Earth study. Yeah.
And you cannot rely on...
That's right.
The crops
That's
continue
right.
to be the way at the level they are now.
That's right. There's no guarantee on that. You're right. If we had global warming or ice age, then the effects on food and populations would be dramatic. Under one scenario, if we had an ice age, I suppose we'd all be picking up. It's a curious thought. We would all be picking up, and we would be moving to the tropics, right? And then we would be living on the turf of all those people that we have somewhat neglected over these years. And I think that would be a very interesting reversal. I think that would be a very interesting reversal if that happened. You're right. There is, those predictions are always iffy, and they can be absolutely wrong, and they're usually somewhat wrong. I mean, you can count on them being somewhat wrong. I'm glad you brought that in. Thank you. Let's look at where are we? Number 6 says, will hunger end by the year 2000 or could it? Well, it could, but it won't likely. An organization that tells you we can end hunger by the year 2000 technically is correct. We could. We could end hunger rather quickly. But is it likely that we will do that? Not super likely, because the wheels just plain grind too slow. I mean, it's just, you know, if you're trying to make a major change in your lifestyle, for example, think how long it takes you to pull it off, you know? You kind of have to work at it and work at it and work at it and work at it. Well, now what we're talking about is enormous systems of government, enormous economic forces. And to get those kind of changes, it just takes time. They say in D.C. that it takes Congress 3 years to get its head around the new idea. There's some truth to that. And if that's true for our Congress, it's certainly true for everybody else's government, you know. Number 7, I already mentioned, yes, there's more than enough food. It's unevenly consumed. 1/4 of the world produces and consumes more than half of the world's grain. Is the problem distribution? Well, yes. Yes and no. It's more than just distribution, because, yeah, we have enough. If you put it all in one pile and pass it around evenly, yeah, we'd have enough. No problem. But some people don't want to be passed around our food. They want to grow their own. some people don't want to eat the kind of stuff that we might eat, you know, from our great Midwest granaries. So distribution depends on a lot of things: jobs, income, land ownership, and other stuff. What about food aid, number 9? Well, that's something, you know, that slips right by most of us, in fact. You know, we started sending food aid. The idea was, we have surplus food, here these countries don't have enough, let's send them food. A lot of hunger organizations believe that food aid is a very mixed bag of stuff. For a number of years, this is no longer true. It used to be true, but it's no longer true. But it shows you what can happen if you don't watch what's going on in Washington. After the Surgeon General made his report on smoking, for some years, tobacco was shipped as part of U.S. food aid. It was a way that the government could pick up slack that the tobacco growers were experiencing because there was a big drop in smoking for a while there, and it started climbing back up, and I don't know where it is now compared to, you know, where it was then. But for a time, because tobacco leaf is a leaf, I mean, it's some kind of, quote, agricultural product, for a time, a certain amount of tobacco leaf was shipped under food aid provisions. So they say, oh, great, we're sending tons of food aid to Turkey. Well, it was tobacco leaf, folks, and they were rolling it and making it into cigarettes. I mean, you don't eat the stuff, I guess. They don't do that anymore. But it's an example. Our feeling is that emergency food aid is good. Some of you may have attended a session or sessions by Jane Rossing. Jane was in Africa, and we talked a little bit about food aid just over lunch one day. And she said she saw situations where U.S. and other countries' food aid really did help save lives. It really was a blessing to the people who are there. Other food aid hurts third world countries. Can you believe we are actually spending tax dollars to send food that is not helpful to third world people? How can that be? Well, sometimes we ship that. First of all, a lot of that food aid is not shipped free. We charge for a lot of it. We charge governments. We ship it to other governments. Second of all, sometimes that food invades a market over there at a price that is so cheap. Because, see, we subsidize our growing in this country. We subsidize the agricultural sector of this country. 4 years ago, it was the rate of $26 billion a year. Now it's around $8 or $9 billion a year. So we can ship that stuff over there very, very cheap. What happens? You've got some peasant farmer over here who's growing a crop, and they're growing for their family, and they're growing a little bit extra to sell. We ship tons of grain over there that's practically free, and that peasant farmer can't compete with our cheap grain. What happens? They get driven off the land. They can't afford to grow things anymore. They can buy food cheaper at the market than they can grow it. I mean, if they have to buy fertilizer and stuff like that. So what happens is a lot of small farmers get driven off the land, and they wind up what? You know, just like this country. They wind up hungry. They go to cities. They wind up in the urban slums and places like that. So some U.S. food aid is a federally subsidized marketing technique to get third world people to like our food so that we can create markets so we can later sell them food. It's sort of like, in a way, McDonald's, you know. McDonald's, they don't know, but McDonald's goes over there and you create a need for it and you do advertising, all that kind of stuff. All of a sudden, then you start selling a lot of, products. So one of the things you have to do if you're interested in hunger, not have to do, that's a terrible overstatement. One of the things that is helpful to do is to be connected with some organization, and there are a number of good organizations, that is monitoring some of this stuff and that gives you good information that helps you to know which aid helps and which aid hurts. Sometimes the solution to hunger is less money, and sometimes it's more money. It's not always more money. you know, we think, well, more money. Not always the answer. Sometimes it is. What is the main cause of hunger? Number 10. Not drought, not desertification, the main causes of hunger, the main cause, if you had to get it down to one, it's poverty. If you'll let me have two, it's poverty and militarization. That is, why are people starving in Eritrea and Tigray today, in the Horn of Africa? I don't know if you know the Horn of Africa. That's language I wasn't familiar with. I don't know. It's just where I grew up. People didn't know the Horn of Africa.
You can use that map over there.
Oh, okay. Thank you.
On the same.
Yeah, that's not quite as dramatic, but it gets the general picture. If this was a rhinoceros head, okay, this would be the horn, okay? This part up here, okay? A little hard to see. Usually on the maps this sticks out just a little more. It looks a little more like a horn. The Horn of Africa, Ethiopia, Sudan, Somalia, Tigray, Eritrea. Why are people starving in those provinces? Because of war, primarily. They had a drought, but we can ship food. There's lots of food. Primarily because, I mean, it's kind of an age-old custom when you think about it. It's not a good one. Not all old customs are good customs. But, you know, when you wanted to have victory over a city, what did you do?
Starve them out.
Starve them out, you betcha. You surround them. You surround them and you starve them out. Or you poison the wells or something like that. That's been going on kind of ever since there were cities. Well, in the case of Ethiopia, the main problem right now is that if you try to send food, well, there are two problems. One is, if you send food to the government, they feed the troops and withhold the food from the rebels. But it's the rebels out there in the bush that are the most hungry. The other problem is that sometimes the rebels shoot the trucks too. I mean, it's just one of those things. So what a lot of organizations have worked on is to get both sides to agree to a temporary armistice. And then to send the money to groups like Lutheran World Relief, Catholic Relief Services, and so forth, who get trucks and they ship that stuff across the border, the northern border, which is closest to the provinces where the hunger actually is. And only within the last 3 months or so, they got a very tentative kind of truce there. Honestly, I've been on the road now for 2.5 weeks, and so I've lost, it doesn't make the news every day, and I haven't been able to call the office and find out what's going on. But they sent in a few trucks, and it was a day-to-day kind of thing. Will they shoot on the trucks, or will they not shoot at the trucks? But they got a temporary truce, they were getting food in, and the situation was indeed, at least the worst part of it, was alleviating a little bit. But essentially, the problems they had in the prior famine didn't get changed. Number 11, what role does unemployment play in hunger? In the United States, unemployment is a major factor, and also in low-income countries. We already talked a little bit about population growth. Number 15, to what extent do economic systems contribute to hunger? Well, there's a problem, isn't it? I already said that the government of Ethiopia would hold the food and starve the rebels. Ethiopia is a communist regime. But by the same token, a capitalist regime, market economics, have no values. That is, the market system has no way of deciding that poor people should get fed. The market system goes, stuff goes where the dollars go, okay? So in a market system, those who have the most dollars always have the most stuff. So whichever economic system you're working with, there is no assurance that hungry people will be fed, and that both economic systems contribute negatively to hunger at one time or in one place or another. You had your hand up.
About 6 weeks ago, I saw this footage shot in Ethiopia, and it showed all these people, there's a large camp, and all these people were waiting for food to be distributed, and they weren't letting people from rebel-held territories have
into the
food.
Camp.
Uh-huh. And so these people came, and they didn't have the strength to go back home. So it was just a whole bunch of people that were going to die in a couple of days. Mm-hmm. And the food was there, and
they wouldn't let them in.
And they were just, it was, so that's how governments can use food as a weapon.
Right.
Just
it's militarism. Obvious. It's militarism. It's vicious. And it's very hard. I mean, what do you, you know, when you think about it, we have no world government, right? So if the government of a country decides it's going to do this or do that, what can you do to stop it? Sure, the United Nations can enact sanctions. Individual nations can enact sanctions. But the extent to which we have the power or the authority to intervene in the decisions of a government, it's very, very limited. Very limited. I skipped a couple of things along here I wanted to mention. Oh yeah, about the population thing. I had some figures on that, about population growth. Take, for example, Holland. Holland has 1,079 people per square mile, but a very high standard of living. India only has 613 people per square mile, but a very low standard of living. So India has a lot more people, but per square mile, Holland has a lot more people, and so it's not just a question of how many people or how many people per mile. Another fact I was going to mention and forgot to, I had it on a separate piece of paper here, was in terms of the 40,000 who die each day, that's the equivalent of a Hiroshima-sized nuclear bomb every second or third day. It's another way of trying to get handles on it, another way of thinking about it. What about number 16? Does racial oppression cause hunger? Yes, most vividly in South Africa. There is no way that the fundamental problems of South Africa, whether you're talking about hunger, healthcare, education, any of the basic needs of human beings, there is no way any of those problems will be fundamentally solved until apartheid is totally dismantled. I like the poster that's over there in the village center. I don't know who put it up. It's a great poster. It says, yes, Mandela is free, but he can't vote. There are some changes occurring in South Africa. The withdrawal from Namibia, very positive. The freeing of Nelson Mandela, very positive. Beginning to integrate some areas of the society, very positive. One has to acknowledge and applaud where change, positive change is happening. But people in South Africa are a long way from having the right to determine their own future. And and also the other, not only race, but sex discrimination. In India, for example, and in Bangladesh, the mortality rate for female children runs 30 to 50% higher than male children. So both race and sex play into hunger. In the United States, for example, I mean, we still have the lingering effects of slavery and racism. We don't like to think about it very much. We like to think we kind of got past all that, but we didn't. You can't have 300 years or 400 years of doing something and expect it to disappear quickly. You know, it will take, I hunch, another 100 years before American society has fully recovered from its history of slavery. These things move slowly. They really do move slowly. I already mentioned military spending. The amount that is spent on weapons in the world every minute to feed 2,000 malnourished children for a year. Let me say that one more time. The amount that is spent on military weapons in the world every minute could feed 2,000 malnourished children for a whole year. So one of the problems in our country, one of the problems, we've already mentioned that problem as it occurs in Ethiopia, but it's a problem in our country too. It's you know, if you've watched the Congress at all this year, it's been a pretty amazing process. The whole things going on in the world have been pretty amazing. You know, the Berlin Wall and all that. I know I didn't think I would live to see that. I thought that all of that was so entrenched. What's going on in Eastern Europe, amazing, amazing. I am thrilled to the core with this, what's going on in Eastern Europe and Russia or the Union of Soviet Socialist Republics and in Germany. It's just a very exciting kind of time. You would think that, gosh, if we're going to cut back on missiles and we're going to cut back on troops, that there would be a big chunk of money that could be used to reduce the federal deficit. How about that? It could be used to improve education and health care in this country. Congress is having a hard time getting its head around that possibility, and the president is as well. They're going for a $302 billion defense budget. When Secretary Cheney, back in November, some of this stuff is really tricky. You really have to watch these people. When Secretary Cheney, last November or December, said that we were going to make 50% cuts, how was it he said it? In spending over the next 5 years. I think that's what he said. 50% cut. Wow, you go, wow, that's a lot of money. That's, you know, that's really magnificent. I mean, if the administration thinks we can do that, and they're, you know, kind of real strong on having a strong military, that's pretty amazing. Well, what wasn't obvious when he said that, wasn't necessarily obvious when he said that was...
Over here.
Uh-huh. Thank you. That the 50% cuts, okay, let's say that this is military spending if it were flat over the next 5 years, okay? This is where we are now. This is 5 years from now, okay? The cuts were from the Pentagon's projected budget requests. So they were cuts not that reduced the military budget over that period of time, but cuts out of the wish list. At the end of that period of time, we would have still had an increased, though not much increased, not as much increased military budget. So it was not cuts of real dollars, it was cuts in wishes. It sounded like a lot. It wasn't. It wasn't much at all. So, militarism, and I'm sure Tom is going on about that in the next room, is one of the solutions to end hunger, is to cut back on militarism at home and abroad, on military spending. Yeah.
But Reverend Coffin was talking about this, and,
yeah,
and he said that basically it looks like this year's military budget will be the same as last year's. Mm-hmm. And they're hoping that it'll come down for next year, but they don't know how much, and that's what most of the debate that's going on now. The problem with it is, he was pointing out how, like Cheney said, he didn't want all these certain kind of planes, and so that was a whole lot of money that was going to be saved right there. But the congressman whose district those planes were being made got those put back into the budget. So it's not just the Pentagon, it's not just the
right.
State Department and all that, but it's all our congressmen. So you have to, I mean, there's a lot we can do with writing our congressmen and saying, you know, let's cut out the pork belly and read, you know, that's something else they'll talk about as well. You know, if we don't make these weapons, we're going to have all these unemployed people. And so we have to start programs, you know, you know, retool that factory to make refrigerators instead of tanks or whatever.
Right. There are a bunch of complications. One, and you've mentioned a couple of them. One is that I said earlier I do organizing in Texas. Well, I realized, I mean, it kind of came home to me. I was in San Antonio. There are three or four bases in San Antonio. And I went, and they were all worried about what's going to happen to our bases. And then I went up to Austin, and there's an Air Force base there. Then I went up to Waco, which is a little north of Austin. They have the largest Army base in the world, or at least in the United States. And then I went up to Dallas-Fort Worth, where I used to live, and they have General Dynamics that produces the F-16 and Bell Helicopter and a lot of military-related industry. And then I went, where did I go from there? Down to Houston, and I've forgotten what base they have down there, but it's all over. It is all, I mean, if you had been, I don't think this is a conscious thing, see. If I owned a lot of defense industry stock, I could not have adopted a better strategy than to put those things all over the country so that when it came time to vote, I had a lot of congresspeople, you know, voting to sustain those businesses. But it did happen, as you said, through pork barrel politics. That is to say, why did Fort Worth have so much? The average citizen in Fort Worth, if you took the taxes they paid and the income that was funneled into the community from military expenditures, the average taxpayer in Fort Worth was gaining $8,000 a year. I've got those figures somewhere. I mean, I don't know whether I have them with me or not, but for every major city and certainly for every state in the country, how much you were paying and how much you were getting back. Somebody else was paying our $8,000, somebody in Iowa somewhere,
yep,
where there weren't as many military bases.
Aren't any.
Yeah, okay, yeah. It was pork barrel politics, but, and this is one of the re-education jobs that we have to do, quite frankly. $1 million spent on, let me see if I've got this figure right, I've got it written down right here. $1 million spent for military purposes, if diverted to peacetime uses like for teachers and healthcare workers and stuff like that. I think it's 6,000. Where is that? Yeah, 6,600. Billion, sorry. Missed three zeros. Just a second, let me finish this point and then I'll get to you. There is an average net gain of 6,600 jobs for every billion shifted from military spending to public services, such as housing production, education, transit, and employment. The same dollars employ 6,600 more people. Now, I know if it's your town where they're closing the base, you still got a crunch going. I understand that. But in point of fact, a lot of cities where they've closed bases have solved these problems. I heard an NPR, this city in the Upper Peninsula of Michigan. What were they going to do? I mean, who's going to go, you know, who's going to start a factory in the Upper Peninsula? I mean, that's kind of out of the way. Well, it turned out that you may not think this is a very good idea, but this is what happened in that case. It turned out that they put a part of the state prison system up there. Now, you may not think prisons are such a wonderful thing, but in point of fact, they had a need for prisons, and the prisons employ more people than the military base did. And the community that has made that transition is now marginally more prosperous than it was when the base was there, and they don't have to worry about planes that crash and blow up and stuff like that. Yeah.
One of the comments I wanted to make,
sure,
was that the military, yes, does employ a lot of people, and they do make a lot of products. However, when you buy your refrigerator, when you buy your TV, when you buy anything else, your VCR, when you buy your car, it is made in a foreign country. Now, so therefore, what exactly are these people who work for the military going to do when, you know, we're not.
What are they going to do for jobs?
Yeah, what are they going to do for,
sure,
jobs? We're,
sure,
gonna, we're still going to be buying all our stuff from Japan, all our civilian stuff.
Yeah, international trade is a big item. And right now there are some discussions going on at the international level about food. We're buying their VCRs, but they're buying our grain.
I've got a number of people who are engaged in making one versus the other.
I didn't hear what you said.
The number of people employed in raising that grain is far fewer than the number of people making the other product.
Yeah, I think that, yeah, I was just thinking about capital transfer back and forth.
It's more than that, it's jobs.
My impression is, of course, see, a lot of this kind of partly depends on where you live. I live in just outside of the District of Columbia. I work in the District of Columbia. There are drug busts in our parking lot on a regular basis. Billions of our dollars are sliding out to Columbia and other places. I don't think, you know, we could employ people to do drug education. I have not, that I can remember, seen a classroom in this country that couldn't use two teachers instead of one. Now, there may be exceptions. I know there are areas where schools are closing because, you know, there are fewer kids. Healthcare workers. Poverty in this kind of, I don't know what, you know, again, it depends what kind of neighborhood you live in. But somebody tried to kick in my back door not too long ago, just before Christmas. There's a massive, there's illiteracy in this country. There are just enormous, pressing, urgent, life and death problems for some people in this country. And we could use some of those people that we're talking about. I'd like to see those scientists go towards studying, or used to find a cure for AIDS. I think that's more urgent than improving some nuclear weapon. I would like to see those brains turned loose on health care and finding a cure. Can you imagine if we could find a cure for cancer or AIDS? I think that intelligence needs to be loosened up to serve human needs. And I think there's just a lot of jobs that could be free up. Barbara, I'm not giving you a chance.
Well, I was going to say, I think you're right that there's need for people in the service industries. But I think I used to work on anti-nuclear stuff in Connecticut when I was a student there. And we could never talk about shutting down defense plants. I mean, that's really irresponsible because of the jobs thing. But what we were advocating was economic conversion of these plants into producing something else, like buses for public transportation or airplanes for domestic industry. I mean, there are ways to convert munitions factories into other kinds of things. A lot of the Air Force bases that are proposed for closing down can be turned into civilian airports as well. I mean, I think we certainly need to look at shifting. I don't think we should admit defeat in the area of production. I mean, I would like to see a day when more of the refrigerators, TVs, VCRs, whatever we buy, cars, are made in America. I mean, I think we need to work on our own production, and the reason that we're in decline in that area is because the brightest minds go into the defense industry rather than into our best engineers, scientists go into the military sector rather than into other kinds of production. So I don't think that you have to say it's jobs or demilitarized. I think there's a good case that can be made that every single military base or munitions plant can be converted into a domestic
some useful
facility.
Purpose. Mm-hmm. Yeah, I think so. How many of you, when we started this discussion, I'm about to say something, but I don't want to say it if you all already know it. How many of you know what Bread for the World is, or have known what Bread for the World is? Okay. Let me pass out a newsletter here that has, we have been working on what's called the Harvest of Peace Resolution. And there's a background paper about this resolution here in this newsletter. And in fact, there are copies of the resolution right here. So if you want to pass those around, it seems to kind of fold it right now. We have what is called an offering of letters. I'm making a bit of a shift here because time is beginning to run out on us. And one of the pieces in the description of this hour was that I would say something about how we can do something about this, okay? I don't want to leave you here kind of, oh, well, we heard another presentation about world hunger. And, you know, there were some interesting things there, but now what? You know, so what? What can we do about it? We have we work on what we call an offering of letters. Each year, we pick one bill, or we write it. In this case, we wrote this resolution in-house. In fact, we wrote it before the Berlin Wall came down. It's kind of amazing. It calls for reductions in military spending, increases for human needs, reduction of the federal deficit. The federal deficit is enormous. It would be a stack, the current federal deficit would be a stack of $1,000 bills piled 201 miles high. The federal deficit is eating 25 cents out of every income tax dollar that you are spending for present and past things. And it also calls for reduction in our contribution to third world conflicts. Did you get any of the stuff over here? Did it miss you? You? Did you?
Yeah, I got
it. Oh, you got it? Okay, I thought maybe it didn't get back.
You didn't get the other one.
Okay, here's. Did everyone get one of these? Oh, there, the newsletters are coming back. Okay. And it calls for a reduction of our contribution to third world conflicts. For example, we have been sending $1.4 million every single day to El Salvador. $1.4 million every day for the last 5 years, and poor people are worse off today than they were 5 years ago. We are not spending some of that money well. We are the major arms supplier to both sides of a civil war. We supply arms to the government, and then the rebels overrun a government outpost and take the weapons. Or a government soldier, who's probably not very well off to begin with, quote, loses his or her weapon. What that means is sells it to the rebels. And so we're supplying the weapons to both sides of people who are shooting at each other. Meanwhile, fields get burned, peasants get thrown out of the place where they live. The resolution calls for a reduction in our contribution to third world conflicts. Now what we do is produce this kit. We call it a kit. It's actually a sort of a booklet. I don't know why we call it a kit. A kit should come in an envelope or something. I don't know. To me, this is not a kit. But anyhow, we call it our offering of letters kit. And in it, it explains the resolution. It has a fact sheet that gives you basic information. This is like, okay, you teach a Sunday school class or something, or a women's circle or something, or a youth group. And now they've asked you to make a presentation on this, and you don't know anything about it. You've never attended any classes, I don't know anything about it. We try to provide you with the stuff that you would need to know. Background information, questions and answers you're likely to get asked. Then a little theological reflection on the resolution. A five-step process of how to do an offering of letters. Well, what's an offering of letters? It's like when people write letters during church, or when people write letters after or before. You set up a table outside. Or when people write letters during Sunday school. Or people write letters at a women's circle or a youth group meeting. Or like we wrote letters here at Holden last week, and we dedicated them in the Vespers on Friday night. And there's a table set up over here right now in the next building for people to write letters through this week, and we'll dedicate them again this Friday night. We can get 100,000 letters. If you sit down and write your member of Congress, it's a nice gesture, but it doesn't really mean much. But if 50,000 or 100,000 people write Congress at the same time about the same bill, that is political power. That's not just getting good feelings because you think you did something. That's political power. We lobbied last year for the WIC program, Women, Infants, and Children's Program. In response to that, Congress increased the funding something like $192 million. It provides a nutritional food supplement for pregnant women and children who are poor and who go through a health screening and are certified to be nutritionally deficient. Because all those letters came in from all over the country, Congress appropriated funds for additional coverage.
Wasn't that the thing that was wiped down with the budget?
Cutting down now.
Yeah.
WIC is being cut back because 50,000 people are being cut because there was a freeze in Florida and in South Texas. That's one of the main reasons, actually. Two reasons.
Price gouging by price infant formula companies.
Prices went up. Infant formula companies raised their prices, and there was a freeze in Florida and Texas. And when there was a freeze, orange juice prices went up. You all, if you tried to buy tomatoes about 6 weeks ago or 2 months ago, that you were paying a bucket for tomatoes. Prices went up, and all those people who picked the oranges were out of work, so the unemployment rate rose among a certain group of people, and therefore the poverty level rose. Any time the unemployment level rises, the poverty level rises. So yeah, there has been a temporary displacement, and there is some cutting back. But no, we're going for $150 million every year until that thing has enough money to take care of all the pregnant women who qualify and all the infants. I mean, the value of good nutrition during pregnancy is incalculable. I mean, the value to the nation, not just to the individual, to the family, and to the nation. In this particular one, we have a kid each year. We pick one bill. Last year it was the WIC bill, Women, Infants, and Children's Program, food program. Sample presentation, worship aids, a poster, bulletin insert, which you have in your hand, clip art, and activities for children, sample letter, some charts and graphs, and other information. So what we try to do is provide you with information. Suppose that you want to write a letter to the editor. We'll send you know, a kit of stuff with sample letters to the editor. We sent out 3,000 of these to newspapers across the country, so that they would publicize the need for the passage of this particular resolution. The way to end hunger, first and foremost, is lifestyle changes are important, but the way to end hunger is through politics. I mean, I can make these little bitty changes here and there, but in point of fact, if I'm a mouse and Congress is an elephant, the elephant is going to win most of the time. The mouse may scare the elephant, but the mouse is not going to stampede the elephant. The elephant is going to stampede the mouse. So it's through politics. And how do you affect the political process? By joining some group or other that advocates in behalf of the poorest of the poor. It takes a lot of people working together at the same time on something in order for it to influence Congress. They're kind of slow. They're kind of scared. This is an election year. All the members of the House are up for election. A third of the Senate are up for election. Most of them are going to get reelected. 80, 90%, 92% got reelected in the last election. Nonetheless, they're always just a little bit nervous. It's a good year to try to influence Congress because they kind of want to say, oh yeah, I supported that. They want to write you back and let you know that they supported this thing you wanted. So, the way we go at it, and some other groups, Network, the Catholic Social Justice Lobby, the Friends Committee, the Quakers, and other groups go at marshaling these campaigns of letter writing so that the quantity, the effort, the power that is expressed through that really does have an effect on the way Congress does business. We are out of time, and therefore we're going to end. We try to keep strictly to the time. That doesn't mean you can't ask a question or stick around and talk for a few minutes. We can do that individually if you like. And Vespers is in about 8 or 9 minutes. And so thank you for being here and for your interest. And I'll be around also till Saturday. So if some of you are around and catch me along the way, we can talk there too.